Space, the final frontier. These are the voyages of the Starship Enterprise. Its five-year mission, to explore strange new worlds, to seek out new life and new civilizations, to boldly go where no man has gone before.
I'm Tom Fudge. You're listening to These Days, and the crew of the Starship Enterprise has been boldly going for 42 years. We, meanwhile, are still here on Earth watching Star Trek reruns. It's remarkable that this cultural touchstone called the Star Trek series has had so much staying power. The Enterprise may have begun with a five-year mission, but today, four decades later, we're still following the adventures of the Starship's changing crew in all. There have been five live-action Star Trek TV series, one animated TV series, 10 theatrical films, with number 11 now in post-production. Expect its release next year. Since 1964, the space race has moved a long way from the center of the American consciousness, yet Star Trek has managed to craft a story and a world that we still view as exciting, full of promise and optimism. We're going to spend the rest of this hour talking about the enduring appeal of Star Wars. And joining me to do that are John Putnam and Beth Accomando. John is a professor of history at San Diego State University, and he teaches a course on Star Trek history and culture. And John, thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
And Beth Accomando, of course, is the KPBS film critic, and she's a fan of science fiction. And Beth, thank you very much for coming in.
Thank you.
And listeners, if you're a Trekkie, you can give us a call if you want at 1-888-895-KPBS. Beth, Star Trek has been around for more than 40 years. How did it boldly go where no narrative had gone before?
In its own way, yes. And Gene Roddenberry, who created the show, his idea or his innovation, however you want to look at it, was that he wanted to do wagon train in space, where essentially each show would be a completely different idea, completely different subject. Mm-hmm. And so it did do a lot of things that were very different. And it wasn't popular in terms of ratings when it initially came out, but it did inspire a very devoted fan following even from the beginning.
And when you say that it wasn't popular in terms of ratings when it first came out, that didn't change. As a matter of fact, after 3 years, it was canceled because of low ratings, right?
Yeah, after 2.5 seasons, I don't think it finished the third season. So, yeah, it was canceled, but, those fans were pretty ravenous for more, so it had a second life.
Can you give us a little bit of background on the original story? I mean, what time period was Star Trek set in?
I believe it was 300 years in the future. And, it came out in the late 60s, and it was really... I mean, what I remembered so much from the show was how much it reflected the 60s. Even though it was 300 years in the future, you had this sense of, I don't know if you remember that Coke commercial where, all the different nations come together and sing, and you also had the United Nations. And the Star Trek, the Enterprise, was very much this conglomeration of all these different nationalities, and you felt like there was this real sense of racial and ethnic mix and this coming together of diversity.
And, of course, there was that hairstyle and outfit that Uhura used to wear, which I remember.
Multiple hairstyles, yes.
Which I remember very well.
You didn't remember the short skirt?
I remember that. I remember that. She was definitely very 60s. Well, how did the series evolve over the years? I mean, did all the subsequent crews, I talked about the fact that we have five live action TV series. Did all the subsequent crews fly the Enterprise? Were they all members of Starfleet? Did the forces of the Vulcans and the Klingons continue to have a presence in the series?
They did through, there were multiple series. I mean, the one that always baffled me to a slight degree was Deep Space Nine, because it was a space station that didn't really move. So to boldly go.
They weren't boldly going anywhere.
They were kind of boldly staying in one place. So that one always confused me a little bit. But Next Generation, I think, was closest probably in terms of spirit, although Picard was a very different kind of leader. He was played by Patrick Stewart, but he was a much more by-the-book kind of guy. I mean, Kirk was always, he would say you're supposed to play by the rules, but he didn't always. In fact, not very often. So they were interesting contrast in leaders, but they still were tackling similar types of ideas and dealing with social issues and having that sort certain allegorical sense of, you know, being out in space and dealing with aliens, but essentially wanting to deal with current event kind of issues and social ideas.
John Putman, why did you decide to teach a history course using Star Wars?
So Star Trek.
Star Trek. Star Wars, Star Trek.
Well, there's the first problem. Well, I grew up watching Star Trek as a kid myself, particularly with the reruns in the 70s. I was a little too young when it first came out. And in college, I began to, the Next Generation came on, I began to learn a little bit more about the series, about Gene Roddenberry, and that this was much more than just an entertainment show. It was an effort to deal with important cultural, social, and political issues. So I realized that, you know, this could be a way to look at history through a different window, that this would allow us to explore some of the same things I would do in a regular class, but use particular episodes of Star Trek, almost somebody said Star Wars, Star Trek in the classroom and explore how the television show itself dealt with these things.
And what would you say were the values of Star Trek?
Well, I think why there has been so much passion towards it has been, from its beginning, it was about optimism and hope. It was born out of a very difficult time in American history, war in Vietnam, racial strife, cultural change, and a lot of Americans were wondering, you know, about the future of the United States. And here was a show that said, look, we're going to solve all these problems. You know, it may take a couple hundred years, but in the future, we will live a different kind of lifestyle where everybody gets along together and all the problems of poverty that have been eliminated.
Is it that sense of optimism that gives this series its enduring appeal?
Well, I think so. I mean, the fans, you interview the fans, many scholars have studied the fans, and that thing, one thing that stands out throughout. And in fact, it's perhaps why the last series didn't do as well among Star Trek fans, was it seemed to lose some of the optimism and hope. It reflected more of more of the times of the post 9/11. And that was one of the criticisms. So the new movie, J.J. Abrams has promised, he says, I want to return to that unity, that hope, that change, and you know, hopefully revitalize the franchise.
We do have a call from Todd in La Jolla, so let's go to that. Todd, go ahead. You're on the show.
Thanks for taking my call. Talk about unity and change. The first interracial kiss was shown on TV, was on Star Trek with Lieutenant Uhuru and Captain Kirk, of course.
Of course, yes. Kirk always got the girl.
But they were forced to kiss.
They were forced to kiss.
And it wasn't like a romantic kiss. It was, because I was talking to a friend of mine who's a big fan of the show, and he said what was interesting about it is they actually kind of deflected what the contemporary issue would have been, which was the fact that it was an interracial kiss, and instead built this story around the fact that, I forgot what the plot points were, but that they were forced to kiss by
some powerful god.
Yeah, exactly. And so, it, you know, they didn't want to do it because they were friends and they thought that might, you know, do something to their relationship. But anyway, so it was interesting how they brought up what was kind of a social issue at the time and couched it in kind of different terms.
Well, Todd, thank you very much for calling in. And speaking of social issues, Beth, you have spoken, I think, with a number of Star Trek fans about the series, and we're going to hear a few audio montages of what they have had to say. And this first one, which I'd like for you to introduce, I think is about social issues.
Yeah. I spoke to four fans, and they're, one of them is David Glanzer, who's the spokesperson for Comic-Con, which is where a lot of these Star Trek fans will congregate. Raimi Tadaishi teaches science fiction at UCSD. Aaron McFarland was one of our bloggers for the Comic-Con blog that we had. And Jim Lee is a comic book artist who runs Wildstorm. So these were the four people that I spoke to. And in this first montage I have, they talk about kind of how Star Trek reflected social issues and dealt with issues of importance for people.
Star Trek dealt with a great many different issues that were certainly relevant at the time and maybe even today.
Leave any bigotry in your quarters. There's no room for it on the bridge.
I love that. I mean, it was perfect for the time, and I think it still resonates today.
It was really an opportunity to explore divisions of race and ethnicity, and it's easier to do that when you've got a guy who's bright blue and has little antenna that move around like the Andorians, but there's no question that they were examining race in America.
Listen to me. You both must end up dead if you don't stop hating.
Speaking of prejudice, was the episode where these two people from the same planet had this big conflict, and they were both black and white. I mean, literally, one side of the face was black and one side of the face was white. And I remember Kirk saying something along the lines of, what is the conflict? You guys are exactly the same.
Look at me.
You're black on one side and white on the other.
I am black on the right side.
And I was like, oh my God, it is so absurd.
I fail to see the significant difference.
Loki is white on the right side. All of his people are white on the right side.
There's Let That Be Your Last Battlefield was the one about racial issues, or A Private Little War was obliquely about the Vietnam War. But there's a point at which they stop being sort of allegorical and they're very just blunt.
I did not recognize those words. You said them so badly.
The Omega Glory was the episode, and the two factions were called the Yangs and the Comms. It was a very not so subtle, you know, the Yankees and the Communists. And Kirk's big speech at the end, you know, William Shatner always gives this big speech to sort of wrap things up at the end. And his speech was just directly, it was the preamble to the Constitution. He just spoke it word for word at the end.
Look at these three words written larger than the rest, with a special pride never written before. Or since tall words proudly saying, we the people.
We the people. And get that bigotry out of your quarters. Captain Kirk, what can I say? You know, before we have to take a break, Beth, let's hear the next one that you are presenting to us, which I think is a montage about where people are talking about the meaning of war, or what Star Trek has to say about war.
What Star Trek has to say about war, and one of the things I'd ask people is, like, could, you know, our politicians learn anything from Star Trek? So this is part of what they discussed in terms of what Star Trek had to teach about war.
One that really had an effect on me was Balance of Terror. That was a war between Kirk and the Romulan captain.
You're suggesting we fight to prevent a fight?
Based on what? Memories of a war over a century ago?
You know, it's easier to kill an enemy who you don't know anything about or who you think of in very simplistic terms. But in that episode, I remember they fleshed out the dimensions of that character.
I regret that we meet in this way. You and I are of a kind in a different reality. I could have called you friend.
And so you saw that war or conflict or whatever it may be is a lot more complex than you think at first.
If George W. Bush had been a devotee of Star Trek and understood and learned any of the messages, I don't think that there's any way he would have conducted himself in the way that he has.
Yes, well, gentlemen, the question still remains. Can we engage them with a reasonable possibility of victory?
I said that Deep Space Nine was one of my favorite shows ever. It had a war that happened in the middle. To me, that was an amazing look at how we make our decisions and how we deal with aggressors. Not every decision made is a right one, but really explaining the thought process of making those kind of serious executive decisions.
To avoid interspace war, both these outposts and this vessel will be considered expendable. Captain O.
And some commentary about the series Star Trek. I'm Tom Fudge, and you're listening to These Days. Star Trek is the subject of our conversation on this part of the show. We now need to take a break, but when we return, we'll hear more from Beth Agamondo and John Putman about Star Trek. If you want to give us a call, the number is 1-888-895-KPBS. I'm Tom Fudge. You're listening to These Days, and right now we're exploring The Final Frontier, Star Trek. It has been a series on television for many years, and even next year a new movie about Star Trek is going to be coming out. Why are we still fascinated by this storyline? Give us a call. Let us know what you think. 1-888-895-KPBS. My guests right now are Beth Accomando, the KPBS film critic, and John Putman, who's a professor of history at San Diego State University, who teaches a class on Star Trek. And John, we just heard our panel of experts talk about issues related to war and to race in Star Trek. What would you like to say to that?
Well, I think one thing that Star Trek, even from the beginning, obviously came out during the midst of the Vietnam War, and one of the speakers mentioned A Private Little War, which was one of the famous episodes where you have these two basically primitive societies, and one's being armed by the Klingons. Kirk and his crew arrive, and they believe they have to arm their side and keep this balance of war or this balance of power. And again, it was a gesture, or it was basically about the Vietnam War and the idea of the United States supporting the South Vietnamese and the Klingons, i.e. the Russians, supporting the North Vietnamese. And so Roddenberry was trying to comment on that. And again, what he was able to do, particularly in the first series versus the latter series, but what science fiction is able to do is deflect any kind of criticism or concerns. Again, in the late 60s, censorship was a problem. And Roddenberry realized he couldn't get a lot of stuff on television. You couldn't do a show on Vietnam War in the late 60s. It was impossible. But you could do something in the future because it gave you kind of what we call plausible deniability, the sense of, well, no, I'm just making a show about these space guys in the future. But in reality, he's dealing with issues of race, culture, and war.
Let's go to Don in Miramar. Don, go ahead.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I've been reading lately. Well, actually, I learned this a while ago. Barack Obama has a direct relationship with Star Trek. His original run for Congress, or rather the Senate, was against a very charismatic senator or state politician named Jack Ryan, who happened to be married to Jerry Ryan, who was played Seven of Nine on the Star Trek Voyager series, and she divorced him, and in their divorce proceedings there were some sexual misconduct allegations and so forth that came out. They divorced 5 years before the election, but anyway, it came out in time to embarrass Jack Ryan enough to drop out of the race where he was favored to win and allow Barack Obama to get elected to Senate.
So you're saying we have Star Wars to thank for Barack Obama here? Is that your...
Star Trek.
Star Wars. I keep saying Star Wars. I'm sorry. Star Trek to thank for Barack Obama.
Well, they're related. I don't know. That he did most of it of himself, but he was not favored to win that election against Jack Ryan, as I recall, without the benefit of this sex scandal.
Okay. Which wouldn't have been made possible had it not been for Star Trek or something like that. Don, thank you very much. Let's go to Chris in La Costa. Chris, go ahead.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. I just, as a young person, I want to say how Captain Kirk epitomized a leader to me as a young child. And I noticed that he didn't send a delegation down to do his missions. He wouldn't accept that. He was in the forefront of it, or he would take it personally, in the equivalent of George Bush going off to Iraq, I suppose. Not able to scrutinize as a young child, he just really set in motion for me what a leader meant.
And, well, thanks very much. And I guess we have seen some examples of leadership and what it should be in the Star Trek series, both Captain Kirk and Captain Jean-Luc Picard in The Next Generation. Beth, what do you want to say about that?
Well, and one of the things that I liked about all of those leaders was they were also willing to take responsibility for the decisions they made. Even if the decisions led to something that went badly, they never tried to skirt responsibility. And I think that's a very key factor to good leadership, too, and something that I think is very much lacking.
And now your panel of experts also commented on leadership.
They talked about the different leaders in the Star Trek series and especially what Captain Kirk represented.
Captain's log.
Despite all this technology, despite all this incredible power, at the end, it's the guy in the captain's chair that has to ultimately make a decision, and he's very, very human, and he has his advisors, and he listens to them, but in the end, even with rules like the Prime Directive, you have to use sort of your common sense.
I spent my whole life training for decisions just like that one. My whole life.
You can't just follow orders all the time. You have that responsibility, but more importantly, you have to assess each situation on its own and make the best decision you can.
He was the kind of leader that I think befit that spirit of adventure. He was the one who was just unafraid to jump in and try anything or do anything. So that was a good characteristic to have, but it was balanced out by the other two, I think, by Spock and McCoy.
Get out there.
It is your only other choice. Assuming you make it while you still have time.
Will you try for one moment to feel? At least act like you've got a heart.
Spock obviously was the logic and the rational person of the three. Bones was the, you know, polar opposite, who flew off the handle and dictated most by his emotion than anything else.
Spock, you're the most cold-blooded man I've ever known.
Why, thank you, Doctor.
And Kirk was, you know, maybe the mediator. Well, Kirk was not really the mediator. I mean, Kirk certainly had his own definite opinions and ideas. And I think they all learned from each other.
I think that in the late 60s, Kirk was very much the cowboy, alpha male. When you look at Picard, Picard is very much more by the book, straight-laced, you know, metrosexual European type who was very much more even-keeled, and he followed the rules a lot more. And then my favorite show of the Star Trek series is Deep Space Nine. The leader in that is Captain Sisko, and he shows up, and he doesn't want to be there. He just got dropped into the middle of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, which is what the basis of that show originally was.
I never really thought of Jean-Luc Picard as a metrosexual, but anyway, there you are. And what do you think Star Trek says about leadership, John Putman? Because here it's a starship, and they have a military pecking order, which is, I guess, what you would expect. But what kind of a social order do they present, and what kind of leadership do the captains give?
Well, as some of those that just talked about mentioned, Picard obviously, you know, reflected many ways a different time period, the 80s, a more global world. And therefore, you know, you couldn't go off half-cocked when you wanted to make a decision like Kirk did in the 60s. He was the cowboy. And again, Gene Roddenberry started his career writing for cowboy shows.
And he intended this to be a Western.
Yeah, Western in the future, in a sense. Yeah, wagon train to the stars, as he used to call it. And Picard, in a sense, kind of represents that the world's more complicated in the post-Vietnam era. It's coming on. The show emerges right at the near the end of the Cold War. Reagan and Gorbachev are beginning to meet in 86, 87 when the series takes place. And in many ways, it was already looking towards the post-Cold War period when decisions would have to be done with a little more thought and effort.
Let's go to Kate in San Diego. Kat, go ahead.
Hi. I just wanted to comment on the Star Trek Voyager. I was always a Star Trek fan, but when Voyager came out, it was just huge to have the captain as a female and to be feminine, but then also very strong at the same time. And I like the fact that they weren't, you know, just going out on adventures or being sort of political and doing things, because there was sort of a life or death struggle to get home. And I just thought that added another dimension to the story. And as far as leadership goes, I thought that they did a really good job with her character.
Right, thank you very much. Voyager, did you guys like Voyager?
I never got to watch that much of Voyager. The original series is the one that I was most familiar with, and then a little bit with The Next Generation.
I agree with the caller. Voyager was a great show in terms of Kate Mulgrew, the captain. Again, this was a demonstration of how advanced Star Trek was. You know, they have the black captain in terms of Avery Brooks from Deep Space Nine, and then they followed up with Janeway as her character's name. And again, she did have that tough veneer, but they also allowed to show a softer side to her. But she made decisions much like the others did. And it didn't matter what her gender was.
One thing I think about when I think about Star Trek, and I'm interested in what you guys think about this thought of mine, is that it is very much science fantasy. It seems to me there was a time, maybe in the 60s, maybe in the 70s, where we could look at Star Trek and say, wow, that's what it's really going to be like in the future. We're going to be traveling to different galaxies, and we're going to have warp speed, and here we are in 2008, and we haven't been to the moon for 35 years. And does that in any way affect the story, the fact that it is such science fantasy as opposed to science fiction.
But what it got right was it got the humanity of the characters. You know, yeah, we can't transport people, and, you know, certain other things in terms of technology are very different. But they nailed the humanity of the characters correctly, and the point that 300 years from now, 1,000 years from now, we probably are going to be very similar in terms of that kind of composition and you know, our ability to be flawed and make mistakes.
But I also think you're expecting too much too soon. I mean, we're talking 300-400 years in the future. Since the late 60s, we've got the internet. The mobile phone or the cell phone was modeled originally, the Motorola designer, after the Star Trek communicator. That's what inspired him. CNN last week on their election show did a hologram where they had one of the reporters in another room and beamed her in to the main studio. It was the most amazing thing you've seen. You know, it looked like from Star Trek. In fact, the president or the vice president who put this together called the special camera room the transporter.
But we still don't have phasers, you said, on Stun.
Oh, we have Stun guns. I mean,
the cops would love to have that.
If you
could actually set a phaser on Stun, it would be a wonderful alternative to deadly force.
Well, the military has those new weapons, those heat weapons, which they can point at groups, and it basically so hot that they have to drop all their weapons and that. So I guess that's kind of a stun gun.
Well, I think we have come to the end of our conversation about Star Wars. Unfortunately, we're out of time. And my thanks to all the people who called in. And my thanks to John Putman and Beth Accomando. Beth is the KPBS film critic and a fan of science fiction. And Beth, thank you.
Thank you.
And John Putman is a professor of history at San Diego State University who teaches a course on Star Trek history and culture. And John, thank you very much.
Glad to be here.
And listeners, I think we're going to leave you with a few closing comments from our panel of Star Trek experts. So before we hear that, let me say thanks very much for listening to These Days on KPBS.
I think that Star Trek has almost become a little bit of a religion for people.
Embarrassed to say, but a lot of the things I sort of hold very firmly, my personal beliefs came from that show. Loyalty to your ship and using common sense, even when given these sort of overriding directives.
But does our involvement here also constitute a violation of the Prime Directive?
We merely showed them the meaning of what they were fighting for. Liberty and freedom have to be more than just words.
Star Trek helped to create something for people to talk about that included very important moral compass issues.
Granted, it can work 1,000, 1,000,000 times faster than the human brain, but it can't make a value judgment. It has an intuition. It can't think.
One of the things I loved about Star Trek was, even though it was centuries into the future, human emotion, human fears and prejudices still existed. And I thought that made it so accessible.
It's been a part of people's lives for a long time. You're talking about an opportunity for people to spend a lot of their life, to invest a lot of their time and attention into delving into this world that ultimately is filled with positive messages.
We're a most promising species, Mr. Spock, as predators go. Did you know that?
I've frequently had my doubts.
I don't. Not anymore. And maybe in 1,000 years or so, we'll be able to prove it.
Ultimately, I don't know that any show could ever have as much influence as Star Trek, just by nature of how much more there is to look at in Star Trek.
Take us back to where we're supposed to be, Mr. Sulu. Warp Factor 1.
Warp Factor 1. 1,000 years, Captain.
Well, that gives us a little time.